talk today is called intrinsic value. I heard about some more research that I found interesting, also psychology, about the power of choice. So we usually think of the power of choice as something that we want to have. But this research had a different perspective. So the people who were being studied as model human beings, as regular human beings, were given the chance to choose from among 10 prints of artwork. And they were told that they would first rate the artwork from 1 to 10, their favorite to their least favorite. And then when they were told to choose the artwork, they were said, oh, we're out of stock of 1 and 2, but you can have either 3 or 4 and take it with you and keep it. And then they would choose 3. They liked 3 better than 4. And then they were told, some of them, well, we have to send it all off. We have to send everything off to England, and so that's your last chance. So if you're sure that's the one you want, keep it. It's yours forever. Oh, sorry, you can only have 4, not 3. But you can keep it, and it's yours forever, but everything else is going off in the envelope to England, and there's no turning back. Other people were told they could at any time change their mind between 3 and 4. And the ones who had no choice, who had to take the 4, the next day liked 4 a lot better. 4 became 3 or 2 or 1 in terms of preference. And they felt happy and comfortable and satisfied and untroubled. And the ones who had the so-called power of choice, they could at any point decide to turn in the 3 for the 4 or the 4 for the 3. Were tortured and didn't like the painting that they had. The ones who had the one that wasn't their favorite were very satisfied with their painting, their poster. The ones who could have the choice were unsatisfied and kind of tormented by. So it's first of all curious, this potential of the mind when faced with finality, like you don't have any choice. This is what you're going to keep. You can put it on your wall or not, but this is the only choice. The possibility of the mind to actually come to love, to come to appreciate, to come to feel gratitude for what wasn't our favorite, which we wouldn't have chosen first. That is, first of all, an interesting quality that wasn't brought out much in the study, but and then this troubling aspect of mind to torment itself when there seems to be the possibility of having the power to choose or to change the situation. The impossibility of being satisfied with what's going on because maybe we could do it better. Maybe we could twitch it a little bit towards perfection. One of the things that I think is going on here is that when we sense that we have the power to choose, or we've been told we have the power to choose, thinking gets activated. We want to decide by thinking. And when we've been told we don't have the power to choose, thinking gets less activated. There's more of a settling in and just experiencing. And as we experience more intimately anything, even if we didn't like it so much yesterday, within 24 hours we may come to love it best, just through having actual contact. Another kind of title for this talk would be The Extraordinary Ordinary. And how when we feel pressure or we feel responsible to make the right choice, we feel that we're in the position of deciding and making a difference in our lives. The pressure tends to guide us into thinking. And the thinking tends to guide us into lack, to an experience that something is wrong, we're not good enough, or the painting's not good enough. But mostly, I think it's about I could do a better decision rather than that the painting is better or worse. And I've been struck by a quotation from Jay Krishnamurti that I read in one of the talks last week about when there's thinking, thinking can't find a way to create love. That when we're involved in thinking, we're less involved in loving. That when we're involved in thinking, there's a separation. And what he kind of just proclaimed, he doesn't give any evidence for it, but we can check our own evidence. When I'm thinking, there's separation, first of all, he's saying. So when I'm involved in thinking, I could allow thinking and not be involved in the thinking and not therefore be involved in separation. But if I'm involved in thinking, first of all, we can question our own evidence. Is there automatically a sense of separation? And then if there's a sense of separation, does the subject of ownership or possession automatically come up? He says it does. And I'm saying we could check our evidence. I think that what's happening is that we somewhere know thinking to be the inadequate tool to make our life decisions. And so when we go to thinking and get involved in thinking and trust thinking to be a tool that it's not, we sense that there's something wrong, but we think it's us and not the thinking, not the trust in the thinking. We sense a distance from aliveness as we get involved in thinking and trust thinking to be true, rather than just a helpful tool. We trust it to be true. And something in us is uneasy. And I think we also acknowledge somewhere deeply that we alone inside that bubble of thinking, as a separate person, I alone am not adequate to make life flow well. It's not possible for me as a separate individual, an individualist individual. It's not possible for me to come up with the brilliant ideas that life needs to happen through me. And so despite our habituated trust and belief in our thoughts as true and our loyalty to them, I think something in us is uneasy with that. And we could give that a little more space and check our evidence again. What seems to happen when we trust thinking to be true? Then we're trying to do in that separated place or that sensation of separateness. We're trying to do what all of life could do through an individual, but what an individual can't do alone. And that's why we constantly feel that we're not quite getting it right, that our efforts are a failure, that we need to do it better. And then this curious comment of Krishnamurti's that when there's separation, because we're trusting our thinking, when there's separation, immediately comes the question of possession, ownership, jealousy, etc. I think that this is related, that when we sense ourselves as if we were separate. We're not. But in the thinking world, it feels separate. And it feels not enough. And it isn't. Our thinking isn't enough. And if we experience that to be what we are, it isn't enough. And it does need to get something outside it to help it be enough. But moving from that wound of sensing separateness and not therefore not enoughness, we move in ways that just increase the sense of separation and not enoughness, lack and needing to get more, as we have all probably checked in our evidence of our own lives. The more I struggle to get back to that peaceful experience, or the more I struggle to make myself not be angry, the more of a mess happens. The more and more power I need to repress the emotion, the more and more busy I need to be trying to get perfection. Are there any questions so far, or anything you want to say?
To ask a question.
Yeah.
With the sorry, it's tricky to find the words. Yeah, I'm having a strong body response. It's mysterious right now. With this not enoughness, does that, I'm thinking about for myself a trauma triggered from when I was two, and a very strong feeling of not enoughness around that. But it feels like it doesn't really feel like a thinking state. So I'm wondering if that's a different thing, or whether it's the same thing, but there's a other way to look at it.
Yeah. I would agree that the not enoughness state is not a thought so much, but a felt experience that gets triggered. But it's so close to home that it feels to be the deepest thing. And when we take it to be the deepest thing, something in us knows that that's not quite right. That's not quite right. But we take it as, I'm not quite right. I'm really not enough. And so instead of noticing that everyone is getting triggered into not enoughness and having their different strategies and defenses and mechanisms, we kind of try to close it in, and so then we're not actually noticing what is life going on, and what is happening to others, what is happening to myself. We don't notice it as a mechanism, that there's pain and then this kind of covering. And so that's one reason I keep emphasizing the noticing of shame, how it can creep in. So when I experience not enoughness, I want to also say it's not a thinking in the way, like a verbal thought, but we could still call it a movement of mind.
Okay.
And it usually goes with thinking. When I take that as not just one thing that's naturally happening because of that cause and that cause and that influence, but the truth about me, then the shame comes in. Or actually just because it's unpleasant, we're given the message that unpleasantness is a bad sign and shouldn't happen, is a mark against your name kind of thing. You're losing the game. And so the shame creeps in, and we're not able to be in the nature of the experience to feel what's going on and what would be life's response to that. We try to take it on alone. So that then maybe, I think there's two reasons. Then maybe I can fix it, and then I'll be kind of safe and sound to deal in the world, but also safe, and there, it's a vulnerable place to sense maybe not enough. They seem to have enough, I don't have enough. So it's also starting to have a flexibility inwardly of addressing the vulnerability and getting inside the vulnerability and finding that in the vulnerability, we're not separate anymore. The fear is that in the vulnerability, we are separate, and that's where we're going to get pounded. It's so easy to understand how that would come to be our expectation and assumption. Because often when we have been helpless, something has happened that was painful. And so then we take powerless, helpless, as dangerous, and it's a kind of very instinctual no that comes. And so it takes a very wide and sensitive and alive yes.
I suppose I experience it not out of a place of thinking, but as such a primal ground.
Yeah.
And then I have to bring thinking, but heart-mind thinking, but thinking nonetheless to that.
Yeah.
And go, it's not the truth.
Yes,
it's not
good.
The truth.
Good.
So I was just in terms
that's
of
good.
The terms, it was like, it was almost like that was the primary being, the not enoughness, the lack. And I have to bring the mind to help that situation.
Yeah. So, two points. One is to agree with you that many times what seems to happen is that our fears of being hurt and our fears of not belonging, fears of being kicked out, our fear of not recognition, our wish for recognition, our wish for belonging, seem to be tied in to the survival level of our biology. I don't know if that's true, but that's what the experience is like.
Mm.
That sometimes like an insult or even just the hint of a possible insult, someone doesn't smile at us when we smile at them, but we're on retreat and we all agreed that people could be in their own space, but still, it gets in before we do, sort of thing. And there's pain, there can be pain. And it can be a pain of having been kicked out of the human family or something like that, or utter failure, or basically like death. And so something in us scrambles as if to survive, to get some kind of recognition to replace that, or to try to get on good terms with the person that we think didn't like us, or someone else to be our ally against them, or whatever the strategies. And so noticing that, it can be really helpful, as you're saying, to get the pattern and what does it feel like when it's active, and then to be able to use logic to walk out of that in a situation, in a live situation, that's really helpful. There's also another kind of thinking that we can explore, which people talk about the I thought. And I was just today kind of exploring for myself how curious I find it that people call it the I thought, because it's so much an experiential for me. It's a felt thing. It's not just what I think of as thoughts, the little but powerful sentences that might form in the mind or whatever. So in a similar way, we could just notice when there is more of a sense of being a me, who is separate, by the way, and when there's less sense of being me. And when the me comes on strong is often when the not enoughness comes on strong. Whether quite directly, like I feel afraid, and so I feel my defenses, and I feel more separate, and there's an afraid me. Or more indirectly, where the insecurity maybe is lower down, and there are some secondary responses on, of some kind of arrogance, or when we think we didn't realize we were competing, and we wouldn't want to admit that we're competing, but we're kind of out ahead, so we're feeling good. That kind of me, people usually think of as ego. The scared or the negative me, the me that's just trying to defend itself and survive, is often a more strong, powerful experience that we can feel, but we wouldn't immediately call it ego in the Western psychological way, but it is in the spiritual sense. It is the sense of separation, and it's strong. Then what's helpful with the I thought, or we can call it the I experience, the me experience, the separation phenomenon. So partly what Maya's pointing out is sometimes we can find a way, we build a temporary scaffolding to get out of there. If fear tells me there's no way I could walk, 20 meters through the dark woods to the tent where my friend is waiting because someone's going to get me between here and there because it's dark, these kind of primal instincts that get triggered mixed with our past experiences. And we can say, this is a safe place, and almost 100%, not never 100%, but almost 100% sure I could walk those 20 meters or 100 meters, and it'll be okay. And we can choose, in this case, we can choose, it seems, to actually go with something different rather than the habit. So that's one of the things that's kind of in our hands that we can do, that's worth doing. It's going against the subtle and also the intense resistance that we have to walk through the walls of me. Whether it's a fearful me or an angry me, an outgoing me or an ingoing me, an exploding or an imploding. So sometimes people resist lying down meditation because they want to put all of their heart and soul and all of their energy and all of their power into doing the work, working on what needs to be worked on. And that somehow conveniently keeps leading away from actually just doing the really small gesture of walking through the wall of me. Walking through the wall of separation. So walking through the wall of me, so coming out of the habits, walking through that. It seems impossible, but there's a way. Always a way. And so trusting more the possibility of a way through that, it's like a membrane that feels solid, and yet when we get the chemistry shifted into through trust, we osmose right through. And I think I've already said this here, that one of the main things in shifting the chemistry, we could call it trust, or we could call it kind of shedding that cloak of shame, shedding that heavy mantle of shame that just creeps in. We don't even realize we're wearing it, usually. I'm afraid, and I shouldn't be afraid. I've got to get over it. That kind of thing. And sometimes it's helpful to give a lot of space that it's okay to be afraid, it's okay to be afraid, it's okay to be afraid, but it's also okay to not be afraid. It's also okay to be afraid and still walk through the fear, even if it's like a wall of fire and you feel like you're gonna die. But you're pretty clear that you're not endangering yourself. It's not an adrenaline rush game. So I'd like to suggest also another part of what we can do, what's in our hands, is noticing that the tendency, the very human tendency, right from infancy and childhood, right all the way through, where we have role models that whom we look up to. And it's just incredible to watch young children. So recently, Jan and Jess's niece were together. And Jess's niece is about 2 years younger than Jan. 4 years younger than Jan, approximately. And she couldn't take her eyes off of him. And it wasn't that he was doing anything specially interesting, just being a nearly five-year-old boy. But it was incredible, the attention span. While he was doing his ordinary things, she was just really fixated for half an hour, 1 hour, as he moved around the room. So acknowledging that, the power of that in us, looking up to someone, and sometimes that can be of help in stretching beyond what we thought were our limits, in starting to get into touch with what is our potential. If we're drawn to a quality in someone, that's something that's wanting to be born in us, of course. And that there are parts of us deep down that are really itching to be involved in growing that. And how much could we let that be a kind of being drawn on into our bigger self, into our self as we grow up, rather than that person who has that quality that I'm magnetized towards. So playing with not believing the sense of separation in that natural looking up to. And kind of taking ownership of that quality in ourselves, rather than trying to take ownership of that quality in the other person. Which anyway might not be there. Because let's say random number, maybe at least 80% of what we're seeing in each other is our own story. In a more childish psychological way. But there's still room for those qualities that just call our attention, that are beautiful human qualities that we're not recognizing in ourselves yet, but that are sprouting. And I'd like to kind of send out a call into the room to keep allowing this step to happen where we might start off feeling like something's wrong and we want to get help to work with it or fix it, and that's completely valid. It's not like there's one way to deal with not enoughness and that's to tell it to shut up. That's not going to help. It's wonderful to be humbled by the pervasive momentum of not enoughness in all of our lives. And to allow that to open us to be influenced by other people and to hear their experience and make our own experiments based on their experience. But so, if we could also step into a place where we recognize that we're already radiating what's of value. We're already radiating what's precious. We, each of us. And so that we're not kind of following through on someone else's experiences with our own experiments in order to improve ourselves and become a better product that we can sell better. And so it's not a step like up the ladder to acknowledge that you already radiate what's precious. You can't not, even when you're in a bad mood, even when you think you're worthless, etc. Even when there's so much me, it fills the room. What it is a step out of this kind of what I feel I have to call a kind of consumerism that seems to have been born with the birth of capitalism. It seems to have actually come to be so strong as it is today with the birth of capitalism. And we've done that now. And we're now taking steps out of that. into intrinsic value, into radiating preciousness and being humble, into extraordinary ordinariness. Adam Smith, who wrote what became the kind of guidebook of capitalism, just a few years before he wrote that, and I mentioned this in one of the talks as well last week, he wrote A Theory of Moral Sentiment, and he gives this incredibly precise description of not enoughness. And he describes it as if it's intrinsic in the human mentality, which it may be. But I think it's just this flavor of as the power of thinking and the valuing of thinking as true was coming into its kind of fullness, into its fruition at that time that he was writing. The power that seemed to have empowered in the human psyche, competitiveness and envy and ambition. And so he describes a person from a poor family looking at someone with money as if they were gods, as if they were some kind of divine beings. And how that poor person from a poor family, having then believed in lack, believed in intrinsic lack, and believed in intrinsic, not intrinsic, but earned wealth, earned value. The person who has more money is divine. Then throws away the life that had been given and struggles to make enough money to have those expensive conveniences without any gain, without any gain. So he has the convenience, in this case it was a he. It's never always a he, but he has the conveniences which shelter from the summer storm, but not the winter. And in some ways, this is Adam Smith saying, in some ways, having those conveniences make us more vulnerable to anxiety, to sorrow, to illness. This is Adam Smith describing the human being at his time. And so now we've seen where that's come to and what that does. And so instead of being anti-capitalist, we could just notice whether thoughts are true, whether thoughts are worth living by, and what else might there be. And feeling what's important to, what is urgently important to you in the world, what would you love to be different in this world? And coming in, not only coming in, also doing what you do in the outer action, but also coming in and letting that be urgently important to free that and to live by that. For me, it's urgently important that there be, I would wish there would be no, or if there could be less, sexual violence. Partly coming from my past history, partly just looking at and hearing the news, hearing from people. And so I can do what I do outwardly, and I can also go in and try to really find in my own evidence what is sexual violence, how does it happen, what is sexuality, what is violence, what is power, and freeing up as much as I can those different energies, freeing up power, freeing up sexuality, and finding what is the root cause of violence in my own experience. And another lovely and curious comment by the same Jay Krishnamurti. He was asked about people's sexual problems. It was not a specific sexual problem, but just the problem of sexuality, as I think the phrasing of the question. What about the problem of sexuality? This is some decades ago when that would have been less commonly brought up in a dialogue with this sort of very elegant, dignified, well-spoken Indian gentleman teacher who was speaking about only sort of the cut to the bone truth. And so I'm really glad someone dared to ask him this. And his answer is I find really wonderful. Let's see if I can find it. The problem of sex, which seems to trouble so many people, has arisen because we've lost the flame of creativeness. I love when someone who is like British, educated, well-spoken, well-crafted sentences will say his own word. Instead of saying creativity, he's saying creativeness to help us pause and get into the, what does he mean? The problem of sex, which seems to trouble so many people, has arisen because we have lost the flame of creativeness, that harmonious living. So that's his definition of that, of the flame of creativeness is that harmonious living. So he's not giving us directions of how to do it step by step, like one cup of flour, two eggs, but he's saying, you know what I mean, if you really check. There have been moments of harmonious living that we could also call flame of creativeness. And that gives us enough of a clue to go on. We have become imitative machines. We have closed the doors to creative thought and emotion. We are constantly conforming. We are bound by authority, by public opinion, by fear, and thus are confronted by this problem of sex. But if the mind and heart free themselves from the sense of imitation, from false values, from the exaggeration of the intellect, if we could take it so simply that it's just been this exaggeration of the intellect that might have been a needed pause in human evolution. If the mind and heart free themselves from the exaggeration of the intellect and so release their creative function. Release their creative function. So it's not that we have to try to whip them into shape, our mind and heart. It's actually to recover their creative function. So they naturally have a creative function, according to Krishnamurti. Feels true to me. If the mind and heart free themselves, and his way of freeing is just by actually being with what is going on, not escaping from it. If the mind and heart free themselves from the sense of imitation, from false values, from the exaggeration of the intellect, and so release their creative function, it's a release into a natural capacity of a human being, then the problem does not exist. It's almost funny. The beginning of the sentence so long and full, and then we're waiting for that first step of how we could deal with this problem of sex. And he just says, then the problem does not exist. It has become great because we like to feel secure, because we think that happiness lies in the sense of possession. But if we understand the true significance of possession and its illusory nature, then the mind and heart are freed from both possession and non-possession. So it's not, he's not saying, kind of like scolding us, that we Westerners are so inept at austerity, we should just like ride a bicycle more often and give away a few t-shirts and then we'll be okay, or we'll have no problem with sex. The problem has become great because we like to feel secure. So we do like to feel secure, but the curious thing is that we don't feel secure. And we keep going for what makes us more insecure. And so it could be that there are some places and people where we feel more secure and there could be some rest and we could start to get a real sense of what's going on. And we could also find a way of being at rest in an insecure life. That there's nothing wrong with the fact that life is insecure. We don't have to make it not be insecure. We don't have to make it be secure. It isn't. It's not that that's that thing that's wrong with you. And that's why we believe we're not enough. Life is insecure. You didn't make it be that way. And so how we read our evidence, when we notice that life is insecure, do we take it personally? Can we let it be as it is? And find a different kind of steadiness that is kind of filling. And really noticing, as if it's someone else's mind, where the mind goes to try to feel secure. And not to be embarrassed about it. It will go to things that you think are stupid, like clothes, shopping, car, sex, possession, etc. Don't think it's stupid that it's doing that. There's this deeper reason that it's happening. And you can still kind of get behind to a place that notices that going shopping won't make us more secure. But it's not a stupid thing. It's not something to ridicule in ourselves. It's the mind doing its best in a job it's not capable of. So the problem has become great because we think that happiness lies in the sense of possession. And so practicing ourselves away from the belief in not enoughness, where we automatically will go towards having something to feel more sure. But if we understand the true significance of possession and its illusory nature. So here he's really saying it clearly, but in a way that's hard to understand. If we remember moments where we felt, it could have been like a feeling that the whole world was ours, not in a me alone way, but that we really belong here. For a moment, we could feel the preciousness of the wind in the trees or the sun going down, and how that preciousness wasn't different from my own preciousness or the tree's preciousness. And that we already have it all. So I think that's a more maybe experiential example of what he's talking about, the illusory nature of possession. It's strange how when we think we own something, sometimes we treat it really, really well, better than we treat someone else's something. And other times we feel, because I own it, that I can do whatever I want with it. And we kind of don't treat it very well. Having lived for most of my life on people's gifts. So everything that I have is a gift. It's so much easier to notice that it's a joke to think of really owning something, that it's mine. And it gives more of a chance to experience what some of the cultures that came before capitalism have to say about land and other objects. And that with this step towards ownership, what we lose, losing the sense of caretaking our brothers and sisters and being also taken care of by our brothers and sisters, the grass, the wind, the cow, the earth. And what comes through when we're in a state of receptivity rather than going and getting is an appreciation of things and including how the things don't last and how that's part of their preciousness. So the dew on the grass, the wind in the trees. And we can come alive to that intrinsic value in that experience, and that awakens our experiencing of our own intrinsic value. It resonates both ways. Are there any questions or anything to say?
It just makes it all seem so much harder when we go back out there again.
Mm.
You know, the odd thing of being so cocooned in this environment. And
yeah.
Going, yeah, I get all that. I get it. So
yeah.
True.
Yeah.
And I guess it's that thing of stepping out authentically always. And,
yeah.
Mm.
And I think it's important to have a friend or two who also want to step out authentically and who can soften that always, that of course it won't always be, sometimes will be very authentically hiding, taking a break, etc. But the sense that there's so much connection between inner and outer that we could almost not call it connection. It's so connected that to call it a connection almost diminishes what it is.
Mm.
And so noticing a couple of things. One is in your own experience, walking down the street or whatever, driving down the street, whatever. That little shift through the membrane of me, the little shift of whether it's like, this is all mine or none of this is mine, and the lightness of that, whatever kind of flavor it has in the moment. Letting that be with you as you drive down the street or ride in the bus or walk or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It has an effect on your experience immediately. You're in a different world immediately. And even if it then kind of is choppy sometimes, and then again you're back in that other world, and then, okay, but it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
There's also okayness, and then the shift, another shift happens and you're in the other world and other things are possible. I spoke on the first night, I gave a quotation from Emerson that is very much like something in that favorite Sanskrit text of mine, Yoga Vasishtha. It talks about, he said, it's the difference between we move a little this way and we move a little that way, and then suddenly we're in a balloon making these great leaps. Without even noticing that we're making a great leap because the balloon is carrying us.
Mm-hmm.
And in the text, the Sanskrit text, it's called walking on air, or it would be like being in the nest, the bird, and then maybe some other kind of safety. So the intrinsic value of life is untouchable. That's secure. And so when I trust that, then a different kind of movement happens that takes great leaps with no effort. The remembering and the coming back to and the not believing in the frustration and not believing in the I'll never get it and all of that is where we can work. But as the shift happens, letting that happen and take over and move us is where we don't need to work. But when we're in the small mind, we'll think that's not really work. I'm really working over here, looking at my negativity and trying to shift it a little this way and a little that way. And just letting that, I'm not alone in the negativity, for example, spread us out again. Kind of. I don't own the negativity, I didn't create it. I feel it and it hurts, so that also can drop us in. It just hurts and there's tenderness, and in the tenderness there's power. There's the freeing of the heart and mind in its creativeness and its harmonious living. So it's important to notice that your own world shifts with that shift. And it, what is possible and what you notice is different. And it makes a difference for you, and it makes a difference for others. And then having a friend that you can walk with sometimes is very important. But starting to feel that culture is created that way. So without putting it on our shoulders, feeling that the flame of creativeness in the freed heart and mind is harmonious living in the ordinary day-to-day. Mm. Anything else to say, Rask? Mm. Yes,
Catherine. I'm just wondering, like, how do you define, or maybe I know, but sometimes like, how do you define whether to just to learn to love something, to let it be okay, or to like feel it, don't think this is
Yeah. That was the talk I thought I was going to give today.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you're staying 7 days. So we can go more into it. We could touch on it briefly now.
Yeah.
And especially because it goes back to the thing about choice.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a common language now, like we want to make good choices in our lives about where we live and with whom and that kind of thing, which is true. We would love to make good choices in our lives. So partly I think it's feeling for a pattern of choosing, which isn't a free choice, but a triggered pattern of so-called choosing, where I'm drawn into a relationship that's painful and unhealthy, for example. Even then, because as we, some of us know, sometimes we leave that relationship just to go to another one that's the same. Not always, it's not always that way. But sometimes it's the same pattern acting, the same wound chose for us. Sometimes we need more moments where it's that poster that we can't return. We can't change our minds. And so we start to appreciate it. And this is where we don't have many examples in a normal Western, or what we can call it, first world lifestyle. I like being not in the West here,
yeah.
But being in the first world to remind me to change my language. The first world lifestyle in many different socioeconomic strata does not give us much chance to feel that first kind of scenario where we have to choose the poster and keep it. Sometimes we get that with family, with parents or siblings or children, because we can't quite break up with them when it's hard. And often it just remains a struggle and not much light comes in. But I think that's because there's not the acceptance that this is life, that there are things in life to accept, that it's not about improving the person or improving my way of dealing with them or being a better or whatever. But this is a bond that is unbreakable, even if it is sometimes very healthy and helpful to not have contact with that person for either a period of time or forever, depending on the situation. But it's still a bond that is unbreakable. And a deep acceptance of that is hard to come by in the first world. When there is the deep acceptance is when that flame of creativeness starts to be able to work. When there's the should, shouldn't, then that's when we're blocking the creative energy and covering the flame. So One way would be to try to feel into a situation where you had to stay with it and there was some acceptance and what came next. Sometimes if there's a physical illness or disability or something like that, then we get in the first world, we'd still have the chance to stick with, kind of. As a mother, it happens all the time, but to give the sense of that there's no one else who can come in and do it for you. You're the one. You get help, you need help, you can't do it alone, etc. But and that's really what we need to do for ourselves, is be there that way for us. So I'm not getting a nutshell answer. The nutshell answer that comes is, with experience we can start to tell the difference between where we need really a firm, at least try to decide, a firm decision, but it's really like we try to decide firmly. Knowing we're going to have to think ourselves out of the, or through the wall, or osmose through the wall many, many times, out of that habit, out of that dynamic. For it to be a genuine growing away from, rather than resistance making it stronger. I think that when we can remember a moment where there was deep acceptance of anything, that would be a good place to start from. When there was deep acceptance, what came next? And I think that flame of creativeness is a good description. We almost need a near reversal of our now habituated mode of mostly trying to choose, and then if we can't choose or we keep choosing wrong or whatever, then we accept. But more like accepting, which doesn't mean masochism, but accepting doesn't mean that I have to stay in contact with violence or whatever, but accepting. Allows a decision to happen, allows a choice to be made. So we might try to decide to stop smoking, and then we have to try, we get all excited. I never smoked, but anyway, friends that have, all excited that they stopped smoking, and then next year, again. But at a certain point, it can happen by experiencing fully what's happening in that smoking and in the not smoking. The full experiencing of it with eyes open, senses open, flame of creativeness available, there can be that really done with that can happen, done. It can't happen if we're not letting ourselves be in it with the acceptance. But it can happen with the full acceptance and the more full experiencing. And we'll try to go into it more tomorrow.
So, Jaya, what you say is a lot to digest.
Yes.
I'm wondering, do you write some of your talks down that you could go back to, maybe?
Here are my notes. Can you see how messy that is?
Yeah.
And also, that's the talk I was going to give. But it is recorded.
Okay.
And there are the talks on the website from previous years that you can download on a donation basis.
Okay.
This will be up there, if all goes well, eventually.
Mm.
It's all on volunteer when they have time.
Mm.
Sometimes it takes a year, and then it's up.
Mm. What about the things on the board?
That's also on the website. You can download it.
You don't, this really is revolutionary.
Yeah.
Yeah, what you're saying. It takes a lot.
Yeah.
Mm.
Is this some psycho-spiritual? Does it come under that heading?
As you like. Yes. I have no idea. I don't mind.
Can I ask you if you have time?
Sure.
So I was very curious when you said tenderness is power, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tenderness is actually the act of osmosing through the wall of me. Tenderness is actually intimacy with life, and therefore power is there. Therefore the flame of creativeness. Yeah. It's the opposite of our logic of separateness, self-sufficiency, etc. So let's leave some time for walking before supper.